This audio file is copyrighted 2008 by About Faxnet and its licensors. All rights are reserved.
Our guest today is Dennis Balthasar, who recently had the honor of being appointed the Master of Ceremonies at the Aztec UFO Symposium, an honor he also received in the past. Hello, Dennis.
Good morning. How are you?
Before we get into the symposium, would you tell my readers what event originally took place at Aztec that makes this place so famous?
Well, ironically, we had the Roswell incident, which was in July of 1947. And then 10 months later, in March of 1948, supposedly there was a crash up in Aztec, which is in the Four Corners area of New Mexico, up around Farmington, where the four states come together. This craft was something like 99 feet in diameter and contained 12 or 13 bodies. The craft was pretty much intact. It was 99 feet in diameter and came down in a forced landing of some kind. And the story came out back in 1986. It was a book written by William Steinman and Wendell Stevens called The UFO Crash at Aztec. Originally, a columnist named Frank Scully first alerted the world to the story of this thing in a book he wrote called Behind the Flying Saucers, which was published in, I believe, 1950. And then one of the stories in that book was, of course, about Aztec, talking about humanoid bodies that were recovered together with an undamaged craft. And according to Scully's informants, the dish that landed near Aztec was 99.9 feet in diameter, its exterior made of a light metal resembling aluminum, but durable to the point where no amount of heat up to 10,000 degrees, which was applied for diamond tip steel, had the slightest effect on it. And then I, in fact, myself, for many years, didn't take much confidence in the Aztec crash. But in recent years, a guy named Scott Ramsey from North Carolina has been doing extensive research on the Air Force archives and things like that. And I'll talk about him in a minute. But the more research it is done, the more it appears that something did happen in Aztec, similar to what happened here, except that the craft was actually in.
Could you tell us what exactly the Aztec Symposium is?
Well, it started 11 years ago, and for some unknown reason to me, I've been invited every year, which is quite unusual to have a researcher be part of a symposium or a conference every year. You'd think they'd get tired of that.
That's because you do such a good job.
Well, thank you, but I'm not sure about that. But originally, Aztec's library, the public library in Aztec, needed a fundraiser to try to build a new library. And they thought, well, the Aztec crash might be a good thing, and they probably took notes from what happens in Roswell, but all the commercial innovation of Roswell and the UFO incident. So they decided to have a annual symposium in March, and it has grown. In fact, the one we just had last weekend was probably the biggest and best that we've ever had as far as the number of speakers and things like that.
Mm, yeah, I'm going to get into that with you.
And giving Aztec credit, being a serious researcher, I'm not stuck on the carnival atmosphere and things like that which surrounds the Roswell carnival every year. And Aztec doesn't do that. They bring in good speakers, none of the festival type stuff, and really put on a good presentation for the people that attend the conference. And I'm really happy with that, the way they do it.
Who was in attendance this year as far as speakers go?
Well, we had one cancellation. We had James Carrion, who is the international director of MUFON, called 2 days before the conference to tell us that he was sick and couldn't make it, and we substituted a guy named Mike Forston. I'll talk about him in a minute. Dwayne Tudall is a movie producer out of Hollywood. He was there. Mike Forston, who did the Phoenix Lights in 1997. Scott and Susan Ramsey, the Aztec Symposium and the Aztec Crash. Of course, Stanton Friedman, everybody's familiar with, the nuclear physicist, the guy I refer to now as the grandfather of ufology rather than just the father because of his age. Dr. Jesse Marcel, Jr., who is the son of Major Marcel, who was the intelligence officer in Roswell in 1947. Dan Storch, who is a retired police officer out of Aurora, Colorado, who does the research by forensic testing. Timothy Good from England. Everybody knows about Timothy. And then Ted Phillips is the guy that has the Center for Physical Trace Research, and he's just fascinating with the amount of physical research that he's done.
What is the library's position on UFOs, if you know? I mean, do they believe that UFOs exist, or are they just using this as a fundraiser?
I'd say it's about 50-50, Ken. They see the benefit of having the symposium because I think it was 2 years or 3 years ago a new library was completed, and it's state-of-the-art. Not saying that the UFO conference totally paid for it, but it certainly had a big bearing on them being able to get the funds and have it become a reality. The town of Aztec pretty much is like Roswell. You know, they take this thing with a grain of salt, and you know, some believe, some don't, and that's fine. But the reception that the symposium gives to the speakers is just unbelievable.
I see where Disney has contacted the library to get permission to use some of its memorabilia for the remake of Witch Mountain. Do you know what kind of memorabilia that the library has?
No, there's nothing physical that I'm aware of. Out at the crash site itself, some of the interesting stuff that's come up over the years is that there is a road that goes in there. And this is petroleum country where they have wells for natural gas and oil and things like that. But there was a road made into the site years ago that is not on topographic maps from years ago prior to the crash. So we know that a road was established. But the main thing that I have seen there is a concrete slab about 3 foot square, probably 6 or 8 inches in thickness, heavily reinforced in steel, that nobody can account for being there. At first we thought it might be a well cap. We talked to the petroleum people and they said, no, it's definitely not a well cap. There's no reason for that concrete slab to be where it's located, other than the fact it may have been used as a support for an outrigger and a crane when the crash was moved.
Mm-hmm.
We've done some testing on the concrete and also on the rebar, the reinforcing steel inside. And it goes back pretty much to the 1940s. To me, this is a big thing because this is actually something physical that's still there that you can look at and see and test. So we're of the consensus right now that it's possibly because they had to put an outrigger on the claim, but the area there is sloped pretty heavily where the threat came down. At one time, there were some trees that had been knocked over, and BLM land, so I think BLM made them clean that up, but they do still have the trees, and if needed, they can do some checking on them also.
I've learned that the events that took place as far as the symposium were all taking place at the local Masonic Lodge. Is that correct?
Just this year.
You're right.
We've used the Boys Club, the Girls and Boys Club. We've used the schools, and we had better than 200 people on Friday night at the meet and greet dinner where all the speakers were there and got to talk one-on-one with the guests. And then the actual lectures were held in the Masonic Lodge. And the facility wasn't big enough because we had to turn people away. So one of the problems that Aztec is going to have, I think, is finding a facility where this thing can continue to grow.
Well, getting back to the Masonic Lodge, I guess you know that the Masons have been named in quite a few books as helping to cover UFOs up.
Yeah.
Do you think that holding the events at the lodge was a little ironic?
I thought so. When I first heard we were going to be at the Masonic Lodge. In fact, that's a whole other, you know, area of research right there. Between NASA and the Masons, I mean, you could do several hours of research, several hours of interviews. But, I was surprised, but they were most compatible and most willing to do it. We were not allowed to go in their secretive room that the Masons have, although the guy that was head of the Masons in Aztec told us to announce that he would give personal tours through there, and he did. So they did open it up for the public if they wanted to see, and I guess he explained. I didn't go in, I didn't have time, but I guess he explained what the Masons are about.
Hmm.
Interesting.
Oh, I'm sorry. Didn't mean to cut you off, Dennis.
No, I'd say it was interesting, though.
Mm-hmm. I see that all the speakers had a time limit of an hour and 15 minutes.
That's me.
Did any speakers get so involved that they spoke for a far greater amount of time, or did the audience get so wrapped up with one speaker that he had to keep going?
Well, in the past we've had a problem with some of the speakers, particularly what I refer to as woo-woos, and we have pretty much eliminated them from Aztec. We don't even invite them anymore. We have a group that gets together on speakers. Probably within next month, they'll start on next year.
Mm.
And they decide which speakers they want, and we have decided that we will not have any of these guys in anymore. The new age types and the far out guys that, you know, really don't do research and just turn an eco trip. But I've been master of ceremonies, I think this is my third time.
Really? Wow.
Been a speaker or an MC all 11 years. And they referred to me as a policeman. Because what I did was tell them all up front that you have an hour and 15 minutes to do your presentation. If it doesn't take that long, use it for questions and answers. But that I will shut you off at an hour and 15 minutes. And then have a 15-minute break for everybody to stretch your legs and the next guy set up his PowerPoint or whatever he's using. And it worked real well. They were very cooperative with me. They kidded me a lot about the time schedule. But none of them except... I think that Ted Phillips, the last one, may have run over a little bit because he just had so much information. But we kept pretty good on the time schedule. I was happy with it.
Did you ever think about electric shock, you know?
That might work. No, they were real cooperative with me. In fact, at the meet and greet dinner Friday night, I gave them all a schedule when their names and what times they'd be speaking, and asked that they be ready to set up in that 15-minute segment between speakers, and they were all real good about it.
Good. Well, now I'm getting into the part of this interview where I'm going to ask you about different individual speakers and see what you can remember about what they said, you know?
For example, I got some notes in front of me about them, so we should be okay.
Oh, good. Okay. What can you tell us about the Condon Report and what Dr. Roy Craig had to say about it?
There's a lot of discussion about it. It's typical of the Blue Book, where the people that were involved had a predetermined agenda, and I think that was all set up prior to the Condon Report ever being done, and the consequences of it were that it's of very, very little value. Stanton Freeman gave me a copy of a Condon Report that he had done that I had not read yet, and I haven't read, but I want to go through that and see what he has to say about it. But I don't put a whole lot of confidence in the Condon Report, nor do I put it in the Blue Book report, because there are about 700 cases in Blue Book that are unsolved. And what really amazes me, Roswell isn't even in the Blue Book.
Yeah, I know. Well, was there anything new about the Condon Report discussed, maybe that we don't know about?
Not at this conference there wasn't. Uh-huh. No. Nobody brought it up. I think there might have been a question or two about it, but nothing in any detail.
And what did I'm always interested in what Timothy Good has to say. What did he have to say at the?
Timothy showed a lot of slides of different things that he's encountered and researched over the years. He became interested in this stuff back in 1955 when he read Major Kiko's book describing the military and the civilian side of the accounts of these UFOs, and then. In 1961, he began his own research after reading the book by the Air Force intelligence officer, Captain Edward Woodford.
Uh-huh.
And then since then, he's just amazed at the wealth of evidence, including several thousand declassified intelligence documents, some from the United States, some from England. He's lectured all over the world. What I didn't know, he's a concert
I know.
Violinist.
Oh, I know. He was part of the Philharmonic Orchestra.
Yeah, I
like to talk to him. He's very interesting.
He is. And bless his heart, he was sick the whole time.
Wow.
When he got there, he had picked up a cold or flu or something, and he wasn't even sure he could speak, but he did excellent. He doctored himself up for 2 days and got himself okay and did an excellent job.
He's a very nice man. Yeah.
He is. And born in London and completed his formal education at the King's School, Canterbury.
Mm-hmm.
And as a violinist, he gained scholarships at the Royal Academy of Music. Professionally, beginning in 1963, he worked with the London Symphony, the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, and freelance with the English Chamber Orchestra. I mean, these are not country bands.
No, well, his father was a famous musician.
Yeah. And he did a lot of session work, too, which I didn't know, with Phil Collins, George Harrison, mm-hmm. Elton John,
right.
Stewart, and those type people.
That's right.
He's fascinating to talk to.
He is. I want to ask you about Stanton Friedman. Did he give a new lecture, or did he give his usual college lecture?
He did his new, because he's got a new book coming out, UFOs and Science, or something to that effect. And there's another guy with a background working as a nuclear physicist for GE, GM, Westinghouse, TRW. He claims all the projects he was on, the millions of dollars he spent, were all canceled projects. But, of course, his crash at Corona is the definitive story on Roswell and Top Secret Magic. And he's got this new one that'll be out pretty soon. He just wrote and talked about the Betty Hill story, Barney and Betty Hill.
Oh, yeah, famous story.
He co-wrote with Betty's niece the book about Kathleen Martin, the niece, and she has mm-hmm. all the records and stuff of Betty and Barney Hill. But, you know, Stan, you get him cranked up. During the panel discussion on Sunday, where all the speakers and myself were open to questions from the audience, he pretty well took charge, as Stanton usually does, and took care of things.
I really don't know much about Stanton Friedman personally. I've never spoken to him. let's see.
He's my hero. he really is. I've been working with Stanton for the last 12, 13 years. We communicate probably, twice a week maybe.
Oh, really?
Emails. Yeah. In fact, just wrote to me this morning and said he had been asked to do a debate with Nick Redfern from...
I know who he is.
You know Nick.
Mm-hmm.
Nick apparently has some more information, and Stanton's waiting to get a copy of it, and they're going to have a debate, I think, on radio somewhere. I'm not sure where.
Huh.
And usually if you debate Stanton, you come out on the losing end.
Right.
He was on Larry King's show a couple of times because of the Stephenville, Texas situation, and that Shermer and McGahey, both absolute woo-woos in my book. Never, these type debunkers never give new information. It's the same old story. McGahey says that the people that see these things aren't trained observers, and that's not what the people are asking. They just want to know what are they seeing, and not claiming that they're UFOs or anything else.
Yeah, I love when that happens, you know.
You know, Stan and I both have had trouble with the documentaries on TV, because you give so much of your time and research for free, and then when they get it to the cutting room, the editor gets a hold of it, it completely destroys the work you did. We were both on the National Geographic Channel a couple of years ago, and I had spent 6 hours here in town interviewing with them. We used my vehicle to run all over southeast New Mexico, barely got a thank you out of them. And when the story came out about Roswell, the last comment on the TV show was that Roswell was nothing but a myth.
I think I saw that, yeah. Well, you had no way of knowing who they were going to interview and put the clips in of, you know?
They apparently have agenda. Yeah. And I'm about convinced that the documentaries are based strictly on profit and ratings. And there's Dwayne Tudall that was there at the Aztec Symposium. I laid into him pretty heavy. He is doing some good work with documentaries, because he himself realizes what the problem is with some of these documentaries, and he's trying to correct that, but
mm-hmm.
that's just one of many that are doing them.
Yeah, you're right. They do all of that for ratings. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
What does Frank Warren think that the public's perception of UFOs is? The reason I ask this is apparently that's what he talked about at the symposium.
Well, Frank didn't make it.
Oh, he didn't?
Mm.
Oh, okay.
We substituted one of these guys for Frank because he couldn't get away.
Uh-huh.
And there's another one. I've been working with Frank. I don't know if you remember my interception in Oklahoma where I went after the medal back in 97.
I don't recall.
We may not have talked about it. I went after a piece of metal in Oklahoma and got intercepted by alleged Air Force OSI agents.
Well, tell us about this.
Oh. I was with
you. I'm not going to let this one go.
We'll have to do one on this.
Yeah.
I was with the UFO Museum at the time as a volunteer and got a call from a gentleman in Oklahoma who said his dad was stationed here as an MP in 1947, and guarded the ambulance, was taking the bodies down to the hospital, and had a piece of the metal about the size of a silver dollar. The son didn't know his dad had even been stationed here and knew nothing about Roswell. But his dad told him, we need to get rid of this metal because people will kill over it. And he said he took it out of an old foot locker and told him to put it on a nightstand, crumble it up, which he did, and in about 20 seconds it went back to its original shape. And this is exactly what we've been hearing about this memory of Roswell. So I talked to the old man on the phone one time. He apologized for his breathing. He had terminal cancer, has 6 months to live, and was looking forward to me coming over. Confidentiality was a big thing with the family. I promised that. Had a phone number and got over to Oklahoma and called three times after I checked into a hotel and kept getting a recording. And I figured, well, this is a wasted trip and I've been scammed and it's a hoax. But about 3:30, the phone rang at the motel, the hotel, and a woman said, meet him at Denny's restaurant at 7 o'clock. So I went to Denny's and a man and woman came in. He said, are you Dennis? I said, yeah. He said, well, gentlemen, you plan on meeting will not be here. I said, who are you? He said, we're special agents of the United States Air Force Office of Special Investigation. I said, how do you know I was coming over here? He said, we knew Monday you'd be here Friday. I said, my phone tapped. He smiled and said, you know how we do business. I spent 3.5 hours with him, Ken. We talked about the Roswell incident. We talked about Area 51. He had a map of New Mexico. We talked about the crash sites. Had some drawings of UFOs. Talked about the Bible and the religious aspect, the government cover-up. Detailed meeting for 3.5 hours. And then he told me that the family had decided the government should have the medal, not me, which I felt was an outright lie because of the arrangements I had made. So I came back the next day, Sunday. When I got back to the hotel room that night, I had taken a video camera and a cassette recorder with me. In the event that I got to meet the father, I'd like to get him on tape and get his story and then get the medal and have it tested. But when I got back to the hotel, I tried to put down, because I didn't take notes at the meeting, I didn't know what I was dealing with. And when I got back to the hotel, I got the tape recorder out, started trying to talk about everything I remembered. And on the drive home the next day on Sunday, I had a notepad by me in the truck and would think of something, and I'd write a note about that. Kept it to myself for 4 months, and got back on Sunday night, and I called back over there on Monday and talked to the son. And I said, I was very disappointed in what had happened because I felt I was set up. And he said, I can't talk right now. There's someone still here. By that time, another voice came on the phone and told me they didn't do any strong-arm tactics and all this. And then I went public. I was in June of 97. In October, I went public. I had talked to Stanton because when I got back, I was paranoid. I turned the ignition in my truck and didn't know what happened. I put tape over the fender and the hood like police recommend, see if anybody messed with the engine. Didn't know what I'd find when I got back to my residence. And finally, I talked to Stanton. He said, go public. He said, if you go public, something happens, everybody will know why.
Mm-hmm.
And he was right, because when I went public, I probably felt like a weight was lifted off of my shoulder. There it was. The information was out. Now let's see what happens.
Right.
So nothing really took place. Wasn't able to do any checking, further checking. And then in December, I decided, well, I hadn't ever looked to see who owned that telephone in Oklahoma. So I called AT&T, my long-distance carrier, and lied to them and said, doing my taxes and I have some numbers, but I only call names. Can you help me? And happened that the first name of the female agent was the same first name as the telephone was listed to. So I called over there again and told her who I was and that I was very upset and I wanted to give them the opportunity to explain what happened. And a voice came on the phone and said, if you keep messing with the Air Force OSI office, you're barking up the wrong alley. Click.
All right.
I felt that was a threat.
Yeah.
And I got Frank Warren involved. He had heard about it. It was on the internet and stuff like that. And then he got involved. And Frank and I have been working closely together ever since 97. Him and Stanton and I do a lot of research together. Frank is excellent at finding records, freedom of information requests, military records and stuff like that.
Was James carrying on? He's the one you said didn't make it, right?
Right. He's the head of MUFON. He's the director of MUFON. And he called and said he was sick and couldn't make it. We got Mike Forston in his place. And Mike did a, he showed a video that's going to be out on, I think this month or next month on the internet, I think. And it's got, it has some fantastic backing in it. It's got Edgar Mitchell, the astronaut.
Really?
Got the 911 operator that took some of the calls at the Phoenix lights in 97.
Oh, I'd be interested in seeing that, yeah.
Yeah. My hang-up with Phoenix Lights is that they claim it was the Maryland Air National Guard.
Right, with the flares.
Flares.
Mm-hmm.
And that's simply enough to verify, bring them back and do it again and notify the people in Phoenix so that they can videotape it and compare it.
Yeah, that'll never happen.
It won't happen, but that would be an easy way to do it.
What interesting events did Ken Storch mention when he talked about police involvement with UFOs?
What he did, he had a whiteboard, like a blackboard, a chalkboard, and he actually went through the Roswell incident, the who, what, where, when, and why of the incident. And it was kind of unique the way he did it. I'd never seen Roswell presented that way, and it was kind of neat the way he did that. He's gone public with this as a retired policeman. He was a 30-year police officer in Colorado. And at the risk of being ridiculed, he's been, you know, brave enough to go publicly and discuss his police involvement in UFO sightings. He's been on a couple of TV shows, The Unexplained, and Dan Aykroyd's Unplugged on UFOs and stuff like that. In fact, I saw him the other night on the History Channel, I believe he was on, talking about the way he does his forensic testing. He used to be in the Air Force. He was in the Strategic Air Command during the war between Egypt and Israel. And they had some stuff come across radar then that they didn't know about. That was back in the 1960s.
Mm.
But a fascinating approach to doing the research and doing it with the forensic methods that the police departments use.
Well, what I find fascinating about it is the fact that a lot of policemen have seen things but haven't come forward because of the ridicule factor.
Well, some of our best witnesses, Ken, are policemen, airline pilots.
Right, right.
People who demand respect, really.
Well, I'm well aware of that, yeah.
And they just, you know, most of them don't say much. The O'Hare Airport incident was a good example where that airline ground crews and pilots saw this object hovering over the gate at United Airlines. And what bothered me with that is that's the second busiest airport in the United States, and the government could care less whether there's something hanging over the second busiest airport when we're under terror threat every day.
Well, I think personally that the government knows there's nothing they can do about it. They really do care.
But they
put a facade on of not caring because there isn't anything they can do.
Well,
and they don't want to panic the people, you know.
That's an excellent point. I'm glad you brought it up because my theory on Roswell, and this is strictly my theory, I haven't heard many people say this, but whatever was recovered at Roswell, or even Aztec for that matter, 60 years later, I don't believe they know what they have, how it operates, propulsion, guidance systems. Don't know what their motive was for being here, don't know where they're from, and have no control over it.
You know, I sort of feel that way, too, yeah.
And, you know, I think until they get the military advantage out of it, if they can get here, they have technology we can't imagine. So the military will want that technology, and until they get that and they're satisfied with it, they won't go public or admit it ever happened.
Well, I think they may have gotten some extraneous things out of it, such as the shape of certain things that fly.
Stealth F-117 and the B-2 bomber definitely look like something from outer space when you look at them head on. You know, they're just the way they're designed, and I think you're right. I think some of the technology has come from it, although I don't agree with Lieutenant Colonel Corso's day at Roswell, where his book is good, but there's no references in the back to support it. I met him 3 times and liked him as a person, but microchips were developed at Texas Instruments, and the guy that did it got the Nobel Peace Prize for it. So, you know, that don't hold water. He was never a member of the NSA as he claimed to have been, and we were working on night vision, the stuff we had captured from the Germans, the infrared. And then we got this night vision, the green night vision. But the way he presented it, it's plausible and possible because it was so simple.
Well, I always had a hunch that Kelly Johnson, I don't know if you know who Kelly Johnson
is. Yeah,
Oh, good.
Skunk Works.
Yep. I always had a hunch that he knew something.
He was given some information because...
Oh, I'm sure.
The SR-71 Blackbird, the materials didn't exist when he started building that plane,
right.
You know? And I always felt that they had to have gotten the idea from somewhere, possibly.
Kelly was brilliant. There's no doubt about
yeah.
it. Kelly Johnson was brilliant. I think Oppenheimer was involved. I think he knew some of this stuff. I think several others that were involved knew a lot more than was ever released.
I believe that, too. Ted Phillips has been gathering evidence for years at UFO crash sites. What revelations did he make when he was talking at the symposium, if any?
He's working a case in Missouri right now of physical evidence, and he has got over 3,000 documented cases of physical evidence. By physical evidence, I'm talking about craft that come down and leave a physical trace on the ground. And some of these are circular in shape. Years later, grass won't grow up through it. He does a lot of the testing on the soils to find out what's there. This one case, he won't tell us where it's at in Missouri, but he's working it extremely heavy. He, and I didn't know this, but he was, he began his investigation back in 64 when he was a research associate to Dr. J. Allen Hynek.
Ah.
Hynek, of course, started the Center for UFO Studies in Chicago.
Right.
And I think it was Hynek that told him to start doing this physical trace stuff because that's where the information would come from. And then he started specializing in that. And he's invested some 600 cases that I'm aware of. But in addition to that, he has participated in the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics Aerospace Science meetings along with Hynek, Jacques Vallée, and is a member of a select team that went to the United Nations with Hynek and Vallée and Gordon Cooper.
Mm-hmm.
So he's been right in the forefront of this stuff. He's got two books out entitled Physical Traces Associated with UFOs and Sightings in Delphus. And he just started a dive team group where they do underwater research now.
Wow.
So he's actively working this Missouri case, one in Arkansas, and I think one in Slovakia, Ukraine.
Did he ever say anything about, when airplanes land, little pieces fall off, and they find bolts, and they find washers, etc. Did he ever find anything that could be considered a piece of a...
No, he didn't mention anything about any metal fragments of any kind. The main thing he was into is the traces that are left when it sets down,
mm-hmm.
and what it does to the earth, to the dirt.
Right,
and,
gotcha.
And that's basically where he concentrates, I think.
I guess the UFOs are much further ahead of us on that than we are.
I'm sure.
Did Dr. Marcel reveal anything that we would consider new about his father or anything about the Roswell crash?
Have you read or seen his book?
I know about it, but I have not read it, no.
The Roswell Legacy. If it's out of print right now. In fact, they're going to add to it and republish it again. But for your audience, I would, if they never buy another book about Roswell, I think The Roswell Legacy by Jesse Marcel Jr. is worth having in the library.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the book, he talks about some things that nobody had ever heard. He was quiet for 60 years and never said anything. And now he decided his dad had, on his deathbed, had told him, tell the truth when you can.
Uh-huh.
There's no doubt that his dad was a scapegoat for Roswell. He was a top intelligence officer.
Oh, yeah, there is no doubt about that.
In the world at the time. But the amazing thing about Jesse Marcel Jr., he's a helicopter pilot and a medical doctor.
Right.
And he was called back to active duty in the Iraq War in October 2004, shortly after his 68th birthday, as a flight surgeon.
Mm-hmm.
Flying 225 hours of combat missions.
Right, that I know, yes.
And he was discharged again, I think, in 2005, and he told me he's got close to 30 years of military service. But you talk about a credible witness. They don't come any better than Jesse. I'm working with him right now, trying to get my webmaster to do his website. He's not happy with the website he has. And I think my webmaster is going to work with him and work up a new website for him. But some of the stuff in that book is just mind-boggling. And what I like about Jesse, when he was asked questions at Aztec, if he didn't know about it, he said so. He didn't make anything up.
Mm-hmm.
His knowledge is what he knew from his dad. He handled the material from the Roswell incident in the kitchen that night that his dad came back from the debris field.
Right.
And talked about the I-beams with the writing on it and the different metal and materials that were there.
And his father gave him a piece to keep, yeah.
Well, he never admitted that. He was asked that, but he never did admit to it. But he was 11 years old at the time. He said, I didn't know why my dad was waking me up at 1 o'clock in the morning to see a bunch of garbage metal.
Uh-huh.
And then he said after that, he helped Dad put it back in the box and went to bed. And then they didn't see his dad for a couple of days, and that was while they flew Marcel to Fort Worth to General Ramey's office.
Mm-hmm.
And when his dad came back, he told his mother and him, that was a non-event the other night. You didn't see anything.
All right.
So, Jesse is just super. I got the utmost respect for him.
I thought it was kind of unusual that there were some former state officials in attendance. Did any of them have anything interesting to say?
No, but we had one guy there that really bothered me. He was a rabbi at the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. Big old boy. And during the whole Aztec Symposium, he was staying at the same hotel where the speakers were staying, and he'd come down after everything at night, and we'd sit around and visit with each other. And he'd pop questions to us, and I really didn't know where he was coming from. And then at one of the lectures, I don't remember which one, he asked a question which was really bizarre and kept arguing about it, that this was all nothing, there was nothing to this. And I finally went up to him on break and I said, you need to go back to the Air Force Academy and do some research and then come to another symposium with some better questions.
Yeah, right.
He wasn't too happy with me. But, you know, we were really getting tired of him because he was getting personal, like with Stanton. He used to ask Stanton about his religious beliefs and stuff like that, which is not something that Stanton's going to normally talk about.
No, of course not.
And being a rabbi at the Air Force Academy, of course, ran a flag up for me, and I kept an eye on him, but I just never could figure out his motive.
Well, maybe he was just somebody with a big mouth.
Could be. He may have just been harassing us, you know, and just seeing how far he'd go with us. I don't know.
If I was to go out to the Aztec crash site, what would I see?
Well, it's a dirt road to get out there, and like I said, it's in the petroleum field. And once you're there, you walk a little distance, and then you see a spot where trees have been knocked down. It's kind of a bare spot. You would walk on the road that wasn't there prior to 1948, and you would see this concrete slab. And it's my understanding that the craft had come in, had trouble, and made a turn and was trying to miss. It's kind of a cliff. It sits off up in Aurora, up on top of a mesa. And apparently it was trying to miss coming into that wall of that cliff and came down pretty much intact. Inside the craft, they claim they have found two humanoids about 2 feet in height, slumped over an instrument panel, charred dark, the deep brown, which meant that there was a fire inside it. Another 12 bodies were laying sprawled on the floor. The instrument panel had several push buttons and levers with hieroglyphic-type symbols, as well as symbols illuminated on a small display screen.
Well, would I see anything today? In other words, if I went out there, would there be an area maybe where nothing is growing?
You'd see a bare spot, yeah. You'd see an area where the trees have been knocked down.
And no plants are growing there yet or anything?
No, I believe there are plants growing there now that 60 years later. But it's kind of like Roswell. If you go out to the Roswell site, you're not going to see anything. You can go 10 miles out of Roswell and see the same thing.
Right.
You know, 60 years of climate change and wind and sand and stuff like that, it pretty much has taken care of itself.
Did you speak yourself at the symposium, or were you just the MC?
No, I was just MC this year, and I find that that's harder work than being a lecturer because the preparation, you know, I have to do the research and all the speakers, and takes quite
true.
A while to do the research, the background and stuff. And I try to get personal with them, whether they're married, where they live, their educational background, give the audience some history on them.
Mm-hmm.
And the way I do things, and I guess it's my engineering background, is I work up an introduction, and then I send it to them for approval. so that there's no surprises when I do the introduction.
Yeah, no, that's a good way to do it. Yeah.
And they all enjoyed that. A couple of them made a couple of small changes in what I had said, the wording and things like that. But and then actually running it, keeping everything on schedule and making announcements and things like that, it's real time consuming. And we had busy days from 8 o'clock in the morning till 9, 10 o'clock.
I bet.
But as a speaker, you do your thing for an hour and 15 minutes, and then you sit at your table and relax.
Right.
It's different, but I enjoy doing it. I guess I'm part ham, and I enjoy doing it.
What did Dwayne Tidal, the producer, have to contribute?
Well, many of us that were researchers there at Aztec had experienced less than satisfactory results when we were interviewed by a TV documentary people over the years, and we emphasized that to him. His background included producing and writing and editing the UFO file series on the History Channel.
Mm-hmm.
That included UFO Hunters, Hangar 18, which is still being shown, Texas Roswell When UFOs Arrive, Alien Counters, and several others. He teamed up with John Greenewald Jr., who has got the Black Vault website.
Yeah, I know who he is. Yeah.
And has done some work with him and has started his own production company in California. And he interviewed most of us while he was in Aztec for an upcoming documentary he's doing. But he emphasized how films are made and what is involved and many times why they come out like they come out. And he's trying to change that as an individual producer.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's good.
Good presentation.
In your opinion, what was the most interesting discussion?
Ted Phillips was good and Timothy good. Timothy had just a tremendous amount of slides that he showed of different aircraft, different UFOs that had been spotted around the world. He spent a lot of time in Puerto Rico and has done a lot of research down there. He talked about the British records that were supposedly opened, and not all of them have been like ours.
Mm-hmm.
Just a real interesting presentation. But I don't know that I could really pick out one, because, like I said at the beginning, we had probably the best lineup of speakers that I've had that we've had at Aztec in 11 years. Just good, solid researchers with factual information for the audience, and then let them decide what they want to believe.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. If I was to compare the very first symposium at Aztec with the symposium you just had, what would be the major differences?
The caliber of the speakers, the organization of the symposium itself. The first year they had it, it was at the old library, and they used other buildings, and people had to go from building to building to find speakers. And very little crowd, just a minimum amount of people were there. And they've just improved it so much over the years, organized it better. One of the things, and I need your audience to know this, if they'll go to the website, www.aztecufo.com, that's AZTECUFO.com, they're raffling off to make money for the library. They're raffling off a 2008 Chevrolet Eldorado extended cab pickup truck. Tickets are $50, and they're only selling 1,000 tickets.
Mm-hmm.
So, if you want a new pickup truck, here's a good chance to get one for $50. If you don't want the pickup, they'll give you $20,000 cash.
Mm, not bad.
So, you got a 1 in 1,000 chance, and really it's a good deal and benefits the library quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, have I missed anything important that you feel people would like to know?
Yeah, I think with Ramsey, Scott and Suzanne Ramsey, they do the Aztec research, or have been doing it. He's been doing it for years. They met through a raffle at an Aztec symposium. His wife, Suzanne, was a radio show host in Farmington in the Four Corners area. And they thought Scott was single at the time, and so was she. And they thought, well, we'll just have a raffle for lunch with Scott Ramsey, one of the speakers, which they did this year. They have a raffle for all the speakers, including me, the MC, to have a lunch with us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of neat. And the girl that got me, I think, spent $20 on 10 tickets or something like that to have lunch with me. And you get to talk one-on-one with somebody that way, and it's kind of neat. But Suzanne won the raffle for Scott Ramsey years ago, a couple of years ago, and that developed into a friendship, and then they got married.
Uh-huh.
And Suzanne moved to North Carolina, where Scott lived, and they both live over there now. But they were both heavily involved in the symposium for all 11 years. She's been, being a radio show host, has interviewed many of the people. Scott has traveled to, I believe he told me, 31 states, interviewed 73 first and second hand witnesses, and has archived over 3,000 Atomic Energy Commission and Air Force, FBI, and CIA documents. He's also located 3 radar stations that we didn't even know existed in the area.
Mm-hmm.
And there again, that could have some effect on the craft coming down if there's microwave radio, which it was.
Sure.
So there was they are doing some excellent research on Aztec, and I think they're going to come out with a book probably this year on his research into the Aztec situation. I think it's going to be an interesting book.
Yeah, it sounds good. Well, maybe I can make it next year.
Hope so. Yeah.
Dennis, I want to thank you very much.
My pleasure.
It was very informative. I'm sure everybody's going to enjoy reading about this.
Good. Let's do it again.
Sure. Have a nice day.
Bye-bye.
Bye.